Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell, and I'm here representing Solomon Collins, who was convicted of murder first degree in the Superior Court. We're here today to raise two contentions. I'm going to address, as the first argument, the problem involving the Allen charge in this case. The first point I'd like to make is that there seems to be, at least in this trial, there's almost a presumption that an Allen charge should be given where the jury is deadlocked. And that is not so. We should dispense with that. And secondly, I'd like to address the instruction itself that was given in this case and address the two very serious flaws in that instruction, which have never been raised by counsels before, as in arguments, and therefore never considered by this court before. The Superior Court gave a patterns as jury instruction in this case, which was a Superior Court pattern jury instruction, which I think through the pedigree that I could establish through the Eastern Medical Billing decision dates back to the at least the 60s, and it was contained in a treatise or compilation of jury instructions, hundreds of jury, multi-volume treatise called De Vries on jury instructions. And I'm sure as the court is aware, those types of treatises just combine sample jury instructions from all over and try to address every eventuality. So this jury instruction itself we're submitting wasn't just adequately scrutinized insofar as the likelihood of creating an impartial verdict. And I'd ask the court to examine just the particulars of it.
In the likelihood of creating a what?
Creating an impartial verdict, making the jury less partial than it should be, neutral. In other words, the jury instruction, as is the Allen instruction, it was almost like a thumb on the scale of neutrality in that it tipped the jury towards conviction, and I'll explain why. The first problem, says, with this jury instruction, and it was identified and scrutinized in the Eastern Medical Billing decision, is that the dissenting jurors were instructed that they ought to consider whether his or her position is a reasonable one. The dissenting jurors or dissenting juror was instructed by the trial court to consider whether you are being reasonable. The majority jurors, on the other hand, were instructed that they should consider the reasons of the minority jurors to see whether there may be persuasive merit to their position. Now, what is the problem with that? Well, first of all, as Eastern Medical Billing says, points out, this instruction, which was given at trials as below, portrays the minority jurors as holding less reasonable views than the minority jurors. Furthermore, the majority jurors were never asked to reconsider their views. They were only asked to consider whether they were persuaded, says, by the majority jurors, which probably comprised the preceding 11 hours of jury deliberations.
Well, like any instruction, shouldn't we look at this entire instruction as a whole to determine whether it was coercive?
Yes. Yes, okay. As the court did in Eastern, as the Third Circuit did in Eastern Medical Billing, and there are other provisions about don't surrender your conscientious convictions, etc. And the court can look at that as a whole, but in Eastern Medical Billing, the Third Circuit found that says notwithstanding that other says boilerplate language about not surrendering your conscientious convictions, etc. That didn't pass muster insofar as this jury instruction. So the Third Circuit did look at this jury instruction as a whole.
Why do we care what the Third Circuit thinks about the Allen charge?
Because it is an exacting and a fair analysis of what the effect of this jury instruction upon a deadlocked jury.
So you're persuading us that the logic used in the analysis by the Third Circuit is one that we ought to apply here.
Yes,
you're not suggesting to us that there's anything about the Third Circuit opinion that binds us.
No, not at all.
In fact, the Third Circuit decision doesn't rest on any constitutional principle, but rather on the supervisory authority of the circuit court over the trial processes of the district courts, correct?
Now, with all due respect, we disagree with that, Your Honor. Well, in fact,
that's the source of the Third Circuit's authority by its own admission, isn't it?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I cannot concede that. The Third Circuit very clearly decided that, quote, the coercive nature of the instruction to give rise to the court, we view the coercive nature of the instruction to give rise to such a presumption of coercion and unfairness. Eastern Medical Building, Billing, 230 Fed 3rd at 612. No circumstances that would rebut the presumption of coercion so as to render the charge harmless at page 614. So what the court did is took a look at the entire instruction, essentially the same instruction that our superior court gave the jury, and the Third Circuit determined that there was a constitutional violation here.
What is
because it?
Now, I'm having trouble reconciling your answer to my earlier question with your comment now that there's some constitutionally based rooted structural defect that comes from giving this Allen charge. I read that opinion, and subject to your argument, of course, similarly to what I suspect Justice Jacobs was suggesting to you, that the Third Circuit was saying in our supervisory role over the district courts, we do not approve of an Allen charge worded in this way because, as a matter of policy in our circuit, we think it's unfair. I did not read it to say that there is some constitutional basis for their conclusion that it's the kind of structural error that would constitute plain error in our analysis.
We respectfully disagree.
Well, what is
there is discussion.
Tell me where in the opinion they point to a provision of the Constitution and say it violates the United States Constitution to give this Allen charge.
The two quotations I just recited. In the Eastern Medical Building, they refer to some of their early decisions 20 and 30 years ago and other circuit decisions, and they acknowledge that some of those decisions were, in fact, decided on supervisory powers
what
at grounds.
What provision of the Constitution or what amendment to the Constitution do they cite to support what you just read?
The right to jury trial, an impartial jury. That's fundamental.
Did they actually specifically cite the Sixth Amendment and a case?
No, they did not, but this case stands for that proposition because what it rests on is the guarantee of the defendant being tried by an impartial jury. How more fundamental to our system of criminal justice is than it to be the guarantee of being tried by an impartial jury? Your Honor explained that very well in the Diaz decision.
We're not disagreeing with as what we understand the merits of your argument to be. What we're trying to understand is the basis for the Third Circuit holding. And to the extent you're saying it was the reasoning doesn't matter as much as at the end of the day they said, here's what we think, and therefore in the exercise of our supervisory jurisdiction it shouldn't happen again, or they say, and therefore because it violates the Sixth Amendment it shouldn't happen again.
They did not say that they were reversing this case based upon their supervisory powers. They did not say that. They referred to some other cases which said that.
All of our question to you is, show us in the opinion or tell us where to find it in the opinion where they cite the Sixth Amendment or they cite a U.S. Supreme Court case construing the Sixth Amendment.
Well, we view the statement that the coercive nature of the instruction gives rise to a presumption of coercion and unfairness, no circumstances that would rebut the presumption of coercion so as to render the charge harmless. It is a violation of the right to an impartial jury. This Eastern Medical Building was not decided upon the court's supervisory powers. It was not decided. What was decided was that the defendant was deprived of his right to an impartial jury by virtue of this instruction. And what is the source of the right to an impartial jury? The Constitution.
Well, on page 611, the court said, we are convinced that the particular limits in the content of jury instructions created by Fioravanti and Burley and their progeny, which are Third Circuit decisions, which relied upon application of our supervisory power over the district courts, remain good law after Lowenfeld. which considered whether the challenged instruction violated the state defendant's constitutional rights.
Yes. They remain good law because the court still retained supervisory power to...
The court went on to say, we also believe that the Supreme Court's decision in Bank of Nova Scotia versus United States, while imposing limits on a court's ability to dismiss an indictment in the exercise of its supervisory power, does not require that we depart from our previous rulings.
Correct.
So, you know, a lot of the opinion, you know, which delves into the history, the, you know, the line of Third Circuit cases, seems to be an effort to preserve the court's power to regulate the giving of this type of instruction on the basis of supervisory power and notions of fairness without constitutionalizing it.
They retain that power, the supervisory power. They always had it. But this decision was decided. It says on constitutional grounds. Here we give the coercive nature of the instruction. This is at 612. Here we give the coercive nature of the instruction to give rise to a presumption of coercion and unfairness. That's denial of an impartial jury. I said, Your Honor, explained it says in Diaz. In addition, if the court, you know, if the court believes that there has to be, there must be, some express constitutional mandate for overturning a conviction by reason of a flawed jury instruction, I don't believe this court's jurisprudence supports that.
I don't think that's what we're saying. My original question, which you answered in the affirmative, was, or in the negative, was, is this Third Circuit opinion binding upon this court because it is based or rooted on an interpretation of the United States Constitution which would give rise to such structural error that in the absence of an objection to the Allen charge, we would find plain error? And your answer originally was no, it's not binding upon us. So as Justice Holland pointed out, put the merits of your argument about this is an unfair charge on the shelf for a moment. The answer is the Third Circuit opinion does not bind us, isn't it?
Well, there are two ways of looking at that.
Yeah, the right way and the wrong way.
No, I don't believe that. Well, I'll explain the two ways as succinctly as I can. The one way of looking at it is that this the Third Circuit doesn't have any supervisory power over this court. Agreed. The second way of looking at it is the Third Circuit can authoritatively determine a question of constitutional law which should be reliable as authority for this court, or which this court should follow unless there is a reason not to. I can't.
Okay, but we're really, if this case, if the case that you're relying on, and your whole position is centered on this case, the Third Circuit case, was decided as a constitutional matter, then it would be binding. Or at least would be closer to being binding than one that simply was decided on the basis of prudential considerations with the power to do it stemming from the court's supervisory power.
Agreed.
All right. One question about that. Is there a split among the circuits or is there any other circuit court decision addressing this kind of instruction? And if so, which way are they going?
There are several circuits which address these types of situations, but they can't be neatly says categorized. Several circuits find this instruction to be unfairly prejudicial and grounds for reversal. Other circuits have not found that, but there's various reasons for other circuits not finding that. They don't necessarily find that what I'm pointing out is not unfair or not prejudicial. They decide based on looking at everything that, well, under the context of the case, it was harmless error. There were this, it wasn't prejudicial.
Well, there's always overwhelming other evidence of, and then Justice Risley's point that reading the charge as a whole, the instruction as a whole, it wasn't misleading and therefore not unfairly prejudicial.
Yes, but they have not found that this particular, this particular facets of this instruction were okay. I think just it's fairly uniform that these provisions, three provisions,
well, I take it your position is predicated on the fact that there is not otherwise overwhelming evidence of guilt, correct?
Correct.
That's the exception in Eastern Medical.
We explained, the state made that contention, and we made that, we believe we rebutted that in the answer, in the reply brief.
Can I ask you a factual question? Did the court know before it gave the Allen charge where the jury was standing and whether the majority were in favor of conviction or in favor of acquittal?
No.
So although you're making the argument that the language gave the minority a different standard of review, so to speak, in terms of how they should decide what to do from the majority, we don't know which group that was.
I think statisticians could explain it. I can't. But looking at it this way, if in fact the majority was in favor of acquittal and this instruction was impartial, you know, the likelihood of our being here today would be like hitting the Powerball or Mega Millions.
But you say that in part because the record shows the jury was out for 11 hours before the Allen charge and came back within 2 hours after the Allen charge.
Correct. That is correct.
Do those numbers suggest to you under our four-factor test that the jury was giving thorough consideration to its throughout its deliberations?
I do not. No, I believe it supports a deadlocked jury being affected by this charge. You know, there was only 2 hours of deliberation over the lunch hour after this charge was given.
And why do you characterize that as only 2 hours after they had deliberated for 11 hours before that?
Well,
that's a long time for a jury to be up.
It is a long time. And that long time supports the Allen charge not being given. But secondly, it was from 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock, and that's, I gather the jury was, I don't know whether they were served lunch or not. But, you know, it's, the court decided to give this charge after, decided almost unilaterally to give this charge without, when they heard the manner in which the foreman responded to, do you think further deliberations can help? The trial judge referred to it as that was one of the most unusual no's I've ever heard. Therefore, I'm giving the charge.
Well, if we were to agree with your argument that, or one of your arguments, that the Third Circuit case is persuasive and that we should follow its reasoning, well, one question is what relief or remedy follows from that? Would it mean that there can be no Allen charge, period, or would it mean that a trial judge would have to parse through what is currently the Allen charge and take out, pick and choose among certain elements?
Oh.
I ask that because in the Third Circuit, ever since 1969, their jurisprudence has, in their words, prohibited the future use of Allen charges. And explained that the use of such a charge would, in the absence of extraordinary circumstances, constitute reversible error.
That's correct. That's more or less their supervisory power, and they haven't been giving jury charges. And ironically, this case, Eastern Medical Building, came from the United States District Court in Delaware. But it says, in addition to that, insofar as supervisory power, et cetera, I'd ask the court, you know, among the many things I know the court will consider, but the American Bar Association instruction, which I have a footnote there referencing, says that the American Bar Association, after, you know, apparently very thorough consideration, says in review, drafted instructions in this area, and they're not flawed insofar as partiality towards overcoming the beliefs of minority jurors. Those instructions also, the American Bar Association has taken the position is that the Allen charge should never have been given. A modified Allen charge may be given at the when the jury is normally instructed before they retire to deliberate. That's the American Bar Association's position, that to the extent that there's any Allen charge, the innocuous provisions of the Allen charge should be part of the original instruction of the jury. But there should be no Allen charge after the jury has begun deliberations.
Mr. O'Donnell, this language, if a much greater number of you are for one side and in a like manner that you refer to, which you're focusing on, what is the source of that? Because I frankly have given Allen charges many times, and I don't recollect that language at all in the instructions that I gave.
I can't say that I'm familiar with the exact language of an instruction that you gave, Your Honor, but insofar as this, I think it can be traced back. You know, I tried to trace the pedigree.
Is there a case, a Supreme Court case, that upheld it?
I don't know.
Well, this trial judge probably was relying on the fact it's in the Superior Court pattern instruction.
Correct. Yes.
He didn't do something unusual or out of hand in his mind anyway.
We're not saying that. No, we don't pretend that.
But I think you said it earlier. I'm just repeating it. Whatever caused it to be part of the pattern instructions, this trial judge was simply following the pattern instructions.
Correct.
Is there a pattern instruction number that you have for it?
Sorry?
Is there a pattern instruction number that you have for this one?
For this case from Superior Court?
For this instruction.
Yes.
Can you find that?
Yes, it's Superior Court Pattern Jury Instruction 6A.
Okay. Thank you.
Did you want to save your rebuttal time? You haven't gotten to your other issue.
I know. Insofar as the 3507 statement, I'd like to just point out, it's difficult because it's a fact-driven argument, but there are two statements here, the out-of-court statements of Violet Gibson and Shakira Romeo. In each case, the detective, in his testimony, the 3507 statement, each witness identified Mr. Collins as the shooter, ID'd the shooter. One of the hindrances in judicial review in 3507 situations for this court is a bad record, unfortunately. And what we have here is what we submit is an interpretive statement by Shakira Romeo. Now, Violet Gibson's statement was recorded. The detective said in that she was she identified the defendant as the shooter. Actually, you know, we're lucky, says in this case, because at that point the court apparently marked the detective's notes as Court Exhibit 1. Her statement itself, a recorded statement, it was not introduced as a court exhibit. There was a transcript, however, of her out-of-court statement, apparently transcribed by the state, and I found it in Mr. Maurer's file. And all I want to say is that...
Well, is it part of the court record?
I don't believe it is part of the court record.
Why are you referring to it then?
I shouldn't be. But what I'm pointing out is it's one of the flaws that hampers judicial review of this situation because, you know, that...
Well,
from this transcript, it's the Attorney General's Office transcription. It's apparent that it's an interpretive statement. From her statement, this transcribed, it can't be anything but an interpretive statement. This is... ID'd Collins. That's the, you know, this is the only thing. So, you know, I recognize I have very little time left that I'd like to reserve.
All right.
Thank you.
Could I start off by asking, to your knowledge, is this Allen charge with the majority instruction and the minority instruction the one that's generally used?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I believe it is the standard that is now used by the Superior Court. I know I've heard it in my own practice.
Including those two phrases?
Yes.
Okay.
I do believe that the one that was given here is standard 6A. good morning, again. I first want to just correct something that Mr. O'Donnell said about the ABA and their view on Allen charges. If you go to the website that he cited you to, they don't actually have a pattern instruction. What they have is, here's some elements to instructions. And one of the elements is not a prohibition of an Allen charge. It says, if it appears to the court the jury has been unable to agree, the court may require the jury to continue their deliberations and may give or repeat an instruction as provided in this section. And it explains certain elements about not giving up your conscientious convictions and things like that. It is clear from the Third Circuit's decision in medical billing case that they are, in fact, speaking to their supervisory power over the district courts. This court has taken a different view. This court has, in fact, in several cases, heard the wording of the Allen charge given here, and in Davis and Smith, and agreed that it is permissible as long as it's given under certain circumstances.
All right, if we accept the position that we're not bound by the Third Circuit opinion, should we nevertheless give it consideration and agree with its policy objectives, recognizing it would change current Delaware law?
I think it is something that can be considered and determine whether or not this court has found in practice that these are coercive, but I think that the court has already looked. That case is from 2000. Davis and some of the other cases are from, well, since then. It's been hanging out there. And in fact, what we know is, Justice Jacobs is exactly correct, different circuits view it different ways as to their own supervisory power and what they want to determine.
When we've looked at the Allen charge before, did we ever look at this language specifically that's being challenged?
I don't know. I don't know that it has been, Your Honor. I could not find a case that went specifically to this. That's part of the problem here. They also didn't raise this objection below. In fact, the trial attorney said, I have these two problems, actually three problems, with the instruction. First of all, I don't like Allen instructions to begin with. I think they're coercive. He loses that one. I have a problem with talking about expense, and I have a problem about it being time-consuming. I have a problem with those two. One of those editorials he won, the other one he did not.
Well,
none of these objections were raised.
And the leading plain error case on jury instructions is a civil case, admittedly, Culver versus Bennett, but this theme in the holding applies in criminal cases. And that is, when you look at something for plain error, you're concerned about whether what happened prohibited the jury from discharging its function. And that's really Mr. O'Donnell's argument, that this particular language was inconsistent with what the jury was supposed to be doing under the Sixth Amendment.
I suggest that it's not at all, Your Honor. You have to look at the totality of the instruction, because it does talk about you should determine whether or not your viewpoint is reasonable. You should look at the minority and see if there is something persuasive to what they're saying. And says numerous times, but overall, don't give up your own view, but don't hesitate to look at the other people's view. Don't hesitate to change your view if you're persuaded otherwise. You have to look at all of the language together. And that very same language that seems to break people into groups of if you're towards acquittal or towards conviction, for instance, has support in the standard jury instructions from the First Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit. Different courts view it different ways. And it would be this court's, could this court exercise its supervisory power to say, maybe we should relook at our Allen instruction, and should we look at what the various circuits say and determine whether or not there are good parts and bad parts that we either suggest or reject? Certainly the court could do that.
Well, how could, help me reconcile in my own mind how we could do that in a principled way. The basis would have to be to say, going forward, they'll no longer approve this language. The pattern instruction must change. Wouldn't the premise have to be because the charge as currently structured is unfair and resulted in a verdict that we question as being fair?
I apologize. I wasn't saying to do that in this court and in this case.
No,
what I am saying
not,
is
I know you're
through
not
the
arguing,
committees.
I'm I know sorry. You're not arguing for that, but I'm positing to you that is it a principled basis for an opinion to say we affirm this conviction because the Allen charge as given has precedent and support. We don't conclude that there's a constitutional structural error in giving it. We don't think going forward it should be worded as it was worded in this particular case. There's a better way of stating it. Can we do any of that without conceding that it's so unfair that we should have suspicion about the validity of the verdict in this case?
Your Honor, as we stand here right now, I would suggest there's nothing wrong with this instruction and the way it was given and the way it was worded. But could the court do exactly what the Third Circuit did? And you, if you look at the commentary of the Third Circuit, they said, look, we know what Allen says and all of the elements of Allen. We don't like them. We've made a supervisory decision, and they made it for other reasons also, and that is, it's very hard on the appeal. If you look at Eastern Billing, they said, look, this was a response to the inherent potential of the charge to coerce, as well as the inscrutable problem of determining in each case whether such coercion actually existed.
Yes, that's what's driving the Third Circuit's opinion. And, you know, whether you agree, you know, with their reasoning or not, at least it is, in the Chief Justice's words, principled. You know, their principled approach is basically to say no more Allen charges.
I suppose we don't have to deal with it.
We could do that too. But if we don't do that, and yet, you know, want to improve on what currently exists, how do we do that in a principled way?
Well, I think that the principled way to do it would be through the Court's Rules Committee, looking at various options out of the various circuits and why they say that. Each one of them comes with a commentary. The Third Circuit happens to be the longest when I was just trying to do an overview of them. They really don't like the Allen charge, and they make it very clear. And they say flat out in the commentary, we've made a decision to prohibit a charge from that was given in Allen, even though there is nothing constitutionally wrong with it.
Well, what's the Third Circuit going to do in this particular case if the state's position is just affirmed across the board and then there's habeas review? The Third Circuit's going to say, well, Delaware likes the Allen charge, even though we don't, and that's their option to have Allen charges. But this language within the Allen charge in Delaware is coercive. Are they going to say that, or are they just going to let that go?
Well, they cannot, Your Honor, because under habeas review, the only way that they can look at it and the only way that they can determine that there would be error or some type of constitutional error would be if it's contrary to or involved in unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court of the United States. So Allen controls. Our instruction is wholly in keeping with Allen. So they, and in fact, there's numerous habeas cases that say, not as determined by our circuit, not as determined by the courts of appeals.
So you're saying this majority-minority distinction has already been addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court?
I do not know whether or not that specific language has been or not, Your Honor. I would have to look at it. But what I do understand from our cases that have looked at our Allen instruction before and Allen itself, Lowenfeld, is that this language appears, the concepts that are in it, all appear to be in keeping with Allen and are permissible.
Well, what you appear to be arguing, I just want to make sure I understand it, and in response to Justice Holland's questions, is that if this court were to basically uphold the state's position down the line, and then an effort were made to seek federal habeas review of this conviction, that the argument that's being made now would not be cognizable in a habeas proceeding. Is that
correct? Because Collins would have to prove that there was a decision made by this court, the state highest court, on an issue that he raised and fully exhausted, that was contrary to or involved in unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the United States Supreme Court. He could never meet that burden. Basically, he wants to make a policy decision. This court should look at Allen charges like the Third Circuit does. There are many other views on that. And the state suggests that this court has looked at its Allen charge or Delaware's Allen charge before. And we are in a much different situation, perhaps, than a federal court. I sometimes chide my friends in the federal court that, sure, you don't have a problem retrying a case. For us, a hung jury is quite a bit. It takes a lot of resources and things like that. And so reminding jurors that they have a duty to try to determine the case, if they can, in a way that is non-coercive, is permissible.
Mr. Wallace, and the this court has upheld Allen charges in the past, correct?
Yes.
And did any of them look exactly like this one?
Your Honor, unfortunately, most of the decisions, as I recall, did not have all of the text of the Allen charge. I cannot recall off the top of my head right now one case that had the full.
Was this specific language addressed in any of them?
I'm unsure. I just don't know, because most of the time the court has said this was the standard instruction, it's the one that has been given, and doesn't talk about the various pieces.
Fair assumption that if it had been, and this court had disapproved this majority-minority language by way of example, that the pattern instruction wouldn't continue to read the way it does?
That's what I would believe, Your Honor, or I would believe the court would say, we've looked at that pattern, that's not good. That language is
so it's a fair permissible. Assumption that either this language has never been challenged before, or the court has addressed this language and approved it.
Yes.
My understanding of the Superior Court's criminal charges is there was never a vote on pattern instructions. That Judge Barron prepared a set of instructions which were circulated, but there's no official pattern instructions, correct?
Yes. I was on the Pattern Criminal Jury Instruction Committee. We did quite a bit of work, and then it was turned over actually to Brian Garner, and I know that he was brought in into the process, and Judge Barron, who also oversaw it. And I believe there was one other judge who, I think Judge Johnston has taken over trying to get finalized product and an agreement by all on it. But as the court's cited in its other decisions, there is a standard out there, and this is the standard, to my knowledge, that has been used.
Could you address the harmless error issue as applied in this case? Under the Third Circuit's decision, if an Allen charge is given, that's per se harmful, reversible error. Even if we were to assume for the purposes of argument that the giving of the charge here was error, was the evidence of guilt so overwhelming that it wouldn't matter?
Well, Your Honor,
is there a serious harmless error issue here?
I don't believe there is. At very least, just the two witnesses alone that are complained of in their 3507 statements identified Mr. Collins as the shooter in this matter. There was no harmless. I apologize, and I'm not ready to speak to harmless error because it wasn't raised, and we did not raise harmless error as a possibility because we didn't believe there's any error at all. So I'd have to rely on our factual recitation, but that there was sufficient evidence to believe that any error would have been harmless, and Eastern Villain does speak to that a bit.
Mr. Wallace, in the time you have left, I'd like to ask you a question about the 3507 statement that Mr. O'Donnell raised. In this case, putting aside the merits of what's in the transcript of the 3507 statement that he said is in existence, and then we have the officer's notes. At trial, since the statute says it's the statement of the witness that comes in, if the witness actually made a statement that's either recorded or transcribed, how do we get the officer testifying or using the officer's notes as opposed to word for word what the witness actually said?
Well, Your Honor, I believe in Gibson that's exactly what did happen, that they played the statement as the first one. On the second one, there was no recorded statement, and so you go to the backup, and that is the police officer's recordation and testimony about what the person said.
Or maybe I misunderstood Mr. O'Donnell's point. I thought he was trying to say that in one of them the recorded statement was used, and in the other they were just simply going by the officer's notes, notwithstanding the fact that there was a recorded statement.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that's correct. I believe Ms. Gibson's was in fact taped. Ms. Romero's was not. Mm-hmm. And we understand this court's jurisprudence on 3507 very well. We've watched it evolve, and the state does attempt to follow it in all circumstances, and that is, best this tape, person's own words, put it in, it was redacted. There's no question, and in fact, there's no issue raised about the content of the statements given here. They complain about two foundational questions. Actually, in Ms. Gibson, they complain that it was involuntary. As to the other one, they said there wasn't enough evidence that touches and concerns. And I think that if you actually look at how their testimony evolved, the state has, one, taken into consideration the most recent pronouncement in Richardson, where it said, really, you should only be using it when you have a turncoat or reluctant. Very clear, both of these ladies were reluctant or turncoat, and that they went through the steps they needed to. Ms. Gibson didn't want to talk at all. In fact, had to be treated as a hostile witness by the prosecution for the purposes of getting out the testimony that needed to be gotten out before her tape was played. So I suggest, far from being error, both the introduction of Ms. Gibson's and Romero's is precisely what this court has been telling the state it must do under 3507 and worked exactly the way it should. This court has most recently been also concerned about the use of it when it may not be necessary in Bohan and Richardson. That was both mentioned. And in fact, this was exactly the use of 3507 and what it's meant for.
Well, I hear you in terms of the need to use the statements because the witnesses were turncoat or hostile, whatever. But the issue about the fact that there was no witness's statement as such for one of the two witnesses, because the only record was the officer's notes of what the witness had said. Are you saying that that's an acceptable procedure under 3507?
I suggest yes, it is, Your Honor, if that's all that was generated. Police are encouraged to get recorded statements from witnesses because that puts us in the best position under 3507 in the end. Sometimes, because of factors, that doesn't happen. Where they meet them, where the person's willing to meet them or speak to them, and the circumstances may not allow for recording. I don't know what the circumstances are that didn't allow that here, but I would suggest that there is no hard and fast rule. We know what the best practice is, and I think we try to follow that. But in the absence of that, yes, a witness describing or speaking as to what the witness's statement was is also permissible, just as it is in any other evidentiary situation where a witness may relay a person's hearsay statement or something like that, where it is in fact admissible. I mean, the court made clear in Richardson, look, that it's a slightly different purpose, but we do apply some of the same principles. Because of the import of those statements, I know that the police are attempting where they can to get it recorded, and we encourage that. This just appeared to be a situation where that didn't happen. Maybe out of necessity, I'm not sure. I mean, certainly it's the same detective, so he knows. And where he could, he did record. If there are no other questions, that's all I'll state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Donnell, tell us where I went wrong on understanding what you said earlier. I thought you were trying to say the officer's note said ID Collins, and that if we looked at the transcript of the witness's statement that went along with ID Collins, we would find that whatever the witness said was not a direct identification of Collins, but something you'd have to read the transcript and infer.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Wallace said that two witnesses ID'd the defendant. These are 3507 statements. The state has a transcript of that statement in its possession, and there's a recording in its possession, none of which got into this record. You can't say that and read this statement at the same time.
Wait, I'm confused. Whose statement? You said both of which were recorded?
No. There was one recorded statement, Violet Gibson's statement.
Okay. I thought you just said both were recorded.
No. Right. One was recorded, Violet Gibson's. You can't say that the officer she identified, based upon this statement, and the state has that in their possession. You can't say it based upon this. I believe it's unequivocal.
Well, wait a second. So you're saying that the state had a recorded statement, and instead of introducing that statement, had the officer who took the statement describe what was in it?
Yes.
We just heard the opposite from Mr. Wallace. Where do we go with this?
Now, the jury heard something, but we don't know what the jury heard in Violent Gibson's statement. The officer characterized it as she identified the defendant. But I don't believe that fairly represents what she said.
Was either 3507 statement recorded and introduced into evidence?
Yes. Violet Gibson's was.
Well, but, is that the one you say that's in your
yes,
hand?
Yes, I believe it. I believe her statement is inconsistent with what the officer said was her statement that she identified the defendant. It's not clear.
Well, surely
statement.
That would have been pointed out at trial if that's the case.
Well, Mr. Maurice has tried to make some headway, and I believe he did. But the jury could still consider the officer's conclusion, interpretive narrative, that, yeah, she ID'd the defendant.
Even if they had a recording that never produced the same conclusion that the police officer.
You know, I'm not sure the recording is that clear for jurors. They asked for a copy of that. They asked for that in their jury note. Can we hear her statement again? I believe it was denied.
But your point here is, her statement was the recording, and to the extent the officer was commenting on the recorded statement, he should not have been permitted to do that because the recorded statement should speak for itself.
Correct. I'd just like to make one point about the underpinnings.
One last point, because you're out of time.
One point. The underpinnings of Eastern Medical Building. The court doesn't believe it has constitutional underpinnings, or it has suspicions that it does not. On page 612, the Third Circuit refers to the Bank of Nova Scotia decision of the United States Supreme Court. In that case, the court was careful to distinguish the case from the class of cases which, quote, structural protections have been so compromised as to render the proceedings fundamentally unfair, allowing the presumption of prejudice. That's constitutional. One sentence later, here we view the coercive nature of the instruction to give rise to such a presumption of coercion and unfairness. That's structural error.
Okay, we'll take your point on that. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement to recess.